Think of what we could do if we were as clever as a green plant. Why, we could take that dirty greenhouse gas carbon dioxide and turn it into some clean energy and oxygen. And that leads us to ask, can we make clean energy from dirty gas?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1254th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Topeka who are tuned in to the podcast on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, let's begin with photosynthesis, which is God's gift to planet Earth. As we learned way back when, photosynthesis is the process by which green plants convert radiant energy from the sun and elements from the earth into the stored chemical energy of plant matter. Photo means light, synthesis means put together. That plant matter then becomes the energy that fuels most all living things on Earth, and that is a pretty clever process, don't you think? But wait, there's more. Plants breathe in that dirty greenhouse gas carbon dioxide, break the bond of carbon and oxygen, and then breathe out some wonderfully clean oxygen. What a deal for us living creatures, don't you think? Now, think of what we could do if only we were as clever as green plants. Why? We could take some of that dirty carbon dioxide exhaust coming out of the tailpipe of our car, synthesize it into some clean energy fuel, and put that fuel right back into the gas tank. That would be really clever, don't you think? Well, that thought leads us to ask, can we synthesize photosynthesis? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Matteo Cardinello, who is a professor of chemical engineering at Stanford University. Cardinello, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me here.
Good. And a little bit about your accent. It sounds like you're from far away someplace, perhaps Italy.
Yeah, it is. You're right, Michael.
And as I was saying in a brief conversation before the show, we all love Italy. Cardinello, Stanford says that your group research interests are in the preparation and use of uniform and tailored materials for heterogeneous catalysis and photocatalysis, and the technological exploitation of nanoparticles and nanocrystals. But Cardinello, if a person sitting next to you on a long flight to Italy were to ask you what you do, what would you tell them?
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it? well, the simple answer is that I try and contribute to making the world a better place. And chemistry and engineering help us for a long time, decades or centuries, in trying to make our lives better. And I think we got into some very good inventions, and we discovered some very important processes that are powering our planet and are making our life better. But we also have some drawbacks of those technologies. And now we're trying to work our way back into making those processes as cleaner as possible, and potentially trying to convert those gases that are produced through these processes and that are harmful to the environment into potentially useful compounds that we can use in our daily life.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a wonderful service for all concerned, for sure. Well, Cardinello, when people talk about green energy and clean energy and all of that, they're usually talking about windmills and solar, but you're not. Mm-hmm. You're talking about taking a dirty gas, carbon dioxide, and making clean energy. So this is a significant breakthrough in the way we're thinking, is it not?
Well, it is. The fact is that it's all part of a big puzzle. We have to work together with and discover and or improve many technologies to get to a cleaner energy. So the fact is that windmills and solar cells can provide us with clean, renewable energy. But then it's not just the energy that we need in our daily lives. We can use the energy to power our cars, for example, with electric cars. We can use our energy to power our AC systems, but we also need chemicals. Chemical compounds are part of our lives. If we think about plastics, materials, and anything else that we need, shampoos that we use on a daily life, that's chemistry. Those are chemical compounds. And right now, most of those chemical compounds are derived from fossil fuels. And with all the problems and drawbacks, including the fact that fossil fuels are not renewable, they are going to end at some point, and we are releasing toxic, harmful compounds in the environment. So the idea is to combine renewable energy, for example, from solar cells, windmills, and abundant chemical compounds that we have on our planet, such as CO2 in the atmosphere or water, and produce chemical compounds that we need in our daily life. So it's about integrating a lot of these different technologies to really be able to take advantage of clean, renewable, sustainable energy and produce renewable and sustainable chemicals.
Well, it's very interesting notion that we could take a dirty gas and make so many useful things from it. Where did this notion come from? Sometime in the past, an apple must have fallen on somebody's head.
Yeah, I don't know if it was an apple or if it was some other more dramatic event. Certainly in the last, let's say, this is not a new idea, but in the last 50 years, we realized that there are changes occurring to our planet that are being driven by the higher concentration in the atmosphere of some harmful gases. And one of the most important compounds that contributes to this detrimental effect on the environment is CO2. And now there's enough evidence, I would say, from the scientific community that this is happening. It's really about in the last 50 years that we started asking ourselves, instead of continuing to increase the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, can we do something to remove it from the atmosphere and avoid global warming, or at least stabilizing the temperature of our warming planet? And that's where people started to think about how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, but also utilizing CO2, because at that point, CO2 can be used as a resource, not just as a harmful gas that needs to be removed. And that's when chemical engineers and chemists started to think of how to convert CO2 into useful compounds.
Well, I would just wonder, did it have something to do with the fact that we actually looked at plants and said to ourselves, well, this is what plants are doing. Can't we do what plants are doing? In essence, is that not what you're doing? Is you're emulating photosynthesis?
Absolutely. Biomimicry, which is a word that stands for trying to mimic biology and what living organisms do, has been a source of inspiration for scientists for a long time. Imagine Gecko's paws, for example, that led to different designs of materials that can be used to glue to surfaces, to stick to surfaces. And there are a lot of examples of this. So we looked at plants and we realized, we know that plants are taking CO2 on a daily basis during the day, taking energy, renewable energy from the sun, and combining this abundant compound CO2 and water into very important chemical compounds such as sugars, which is needed for the plant for plant life. So then we looked at plants and we started to think, can we, as scientists, try to reproduce these cycles and do something similar, although the machinery of plants is so complicated, but can we reduce it to its most simplistic elements and reproduce these processes that will lead us to really be able to make a breakthrough, such as converting CO2 into chemicals that we use in our daily life.
Mm-hmm. And we're there. We're making that breakthrough. We're doing it, although we have a ways to go to get there to make it feasible to take carbon dioxide, break it down into a usable fuel and put it back in the gas tank. It's going to take a little bit of time to get there, right?
Yes, certainly we have some way to go still. The fact is that some processes are already there. Like, we have some processes that can make it happen. Not exactly how plants do. Plants would convert CO2 into sugars. We're more interested in converting CO2 into more useful compounds, not necessarily sugars. The real problem, I would say, that we have is that the efficiency of some of these processes is not high enough to make it economically feasible. So in science, we have to fight not just against the efficiency of these processes, but also against the economics. Because I cannot ask a person on, you know, living in the U.S. to go to a pump station and buy gasoline that will cost twice or three times as much what it costs today because it's made using renewable processes. So we really have to be able on one side to improve the efficiency of these processes that we are studying nowadays, but on the other side also make them economically competitive with respect to fossil fuels that are currently in use. So that's why scientists are working so hard to be able to make this process a reality.
Mm-hmm. And that is what Stanford was holding your research up as doing. You've come up with a way of taking a two-step process and making it a one-step process, which makes it simpler and more efficient and more cost-effective, correct?
Yes, correct. So we are studying this process in detail, and right now we're taking CO2 into hydrocarbons. So we could, in principle, take CO2 and convert it directly into gasoline, for example, to power our cars, or a mixture of natural gas that we can also utilize and put in our pipelines and use in our households. The issue, there's still a couple of challenges there. The issue is that compared to photosynthesis, we're not using water directly yet and combining with CO2 like plants do. What we do, we take water and split it, if you want, convert it into hydrogen and oxygen, and then take that hydrogen and combine it with CO2. Uh-huh. And one of the key problems that we have still today is to make that hydrogen in a cost-effective manner compared to getting hydrogen from fossil fuels. Okay. So there's still some work to do there.
So we have some work to do, but we're getting there. And we're getting there, it seems to be, as I've read, in a number of locations around the country. So there's a number of teams working on this problem. Is that not true?
Absolutely. There's a quite large number of scientists and engineers and policymakers as well working on some of these topics. I was reading, for example, this morning how California is trying to pursue a hydrogen economy. And hydrogen is going to be a very important building block in all these scenarios. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple people from different areas working together and trying to make this happen. And I'm very optimistic. I think we made, as a community, as a society, a lot of advances in the last, especially 10, 15 years.
Well, that's a great, we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to go right to your optimism, because we like optimism and we like the fact that we can possibly take dirty carbon dioxide and turn it into good, clean oxygen and energy. Right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place as a USS Dale made good her escape from Pearl Harbor, 7 December 1941.
We're making 30 knots when we pass the submarine nets. Shrapnel was falling like rain as a result of all the anti-aircraft fire. As we passed the first entrance buoy to the channel, we sighted a formation of silver bombers flying high on the clouds. Next, a bomb struck. Close to the starboard side blew mud and salt water all over the ship. Another bomb landed close to the port side, barely missing us. Another passed our stern, and still another crossed our bow. They were trying their best to sink us and block the channel. The Dale must have been wearing a good luck charm that morning. Nary a thing touched us.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Carbon dioxide, that dirty, dirty greenhouse gas. I think it, from what I've seen, it's probably two-thirds of the bad gas in our atmosphere. Is that right, Cargnello? Something like that?
Yes, it is right. It's one of the most abundant, it's the most abundant greenhouse gas present in our atmosphere at the moment.
And yet, you know, the funny thing, folks, is that plants take that carbon dioxide and turn it into plant matter and clean oxygen. What a gift. What if we could take that photosynthesis into the lab and synthesize it and turn it into a chemical engineering process by which we could make all kinds of very interesting, useful things? Cargnello, what can we make by splitting up the bonds of CO2?
Yeah, in principle, there's no limit to the number of compounds that we could make. If we look at CO2 as a source of carbon, carbon is one of the most prevalent compounds on the planet. It's made up a large fraction of living matter. And so at that point, if we're able to find a way to break that carbon-oxygen bond in carbon dioxide and insert hydrogens in those bonds, we could really have a toolkit to make a lot of different compounds that can span from gasoline and fuels to important chemicals to also some of the compounds that we use in our daily lives, like soap, detergents, and all the way to plastics. That it would be really great if we can make plastics, for example, from CO2 rather than making them from fossil fuels. So really it could lead us to a revolution in the way that we imagine chemical industry today.
So where do you start as a scientist? You take the carbon dioxide molecule, and what do you do? Where do you look at it and you think, how do we split the bonds? I guess that's the first step, right?
Yeah, that's an important step. And CO2 is a very stable molecule. That is why it's actually present in our atmosphere in such a large, relatively large concentration, more than 400 parts per million and rising. So it means that CO2 sticks around because it is stable. So when we want to break that carbon-oxygen bond in the CO2 molecule, we have to introduce energy. That's how it is. If we want to break a stable bond, we have to add energy. And that's where catalysis comes into play. Catalysis means that we can break and form chemical bonds using less energy than we would normally need, because a catalyst is a compound that would help us break and form chemical bonds. So when we think about breaking CO2 and forming other molecules, then we have to figure out the right chemical compound, a catalyst, that would allow us to do it with less energy input. And that's where our research really plays a role.
Okay, so in a plant, of course, the energy comes from the radiant energy of the sun. Does that work? That's the gift. And the chlorophyll in the plants then react to that solar energy and do the splitting of the carbon dioxide. And so what we're looking for is a good catalyst then that will help us do the work of splitting. I guess it would be like having a good axe to split a log, right?
Exactly. Yeah. In plants, the system is quite complicated because chlorophylls and other pigments are responsible for absorbing the energy coming from the sun and converting that energy then into chemical compounds that inside the leaves can react with CO2 and water and form sugars. Now, in the lab, we can do that. There are research groups that are trying to integrate everything into one place. Really like having artificial leaves, for example, and artificial plants. Or what we can do to improve the efficiency is to split actually these different elements, the energy absorption and the chemical conversion into a couple different steps. And so in my lab, in my group, what we try to do is to really focus on the step of breaking down CO2 and combining it with hydrogen to make hydrocarbon fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the catalyst, we really need to find a material that would be efficient in breaking the very stable CO2 carbon-oxygen bond and introduce the hydrogen in a in a way that would selectively make just specific compounds. And there's a ton of research that goes into those couple steps to begin with.
Well, you know what? As a rank amateur, as I'm sure many in the audience are, most curious as to how you would go about doing this. First of all, you have to find, you know what you want to do, which is split the carbon atom. You know you're going to need a good catalyst, but where do you find a good catalyst? You don't just go to the shelf, do you?
Yeah. So you can go to the shelf, and that's something that we've been doing as a community for quite some time. There are industries and companies that would take everything they have on the shelf and try different compounds until they find something that would work. And that's been a methodology of research that has been going on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. What we do is a more targeted approach in which we try to understand the chemical basis for breaking those bonds. And then based on that, we identify specific chemical elements based on their chemical properties that could allow us to break that chemical bond. So what we do, we look at the periodic table and we try and find out specific chemical elements that are usually what we call metals, metallic elements, that are very good at binding carbon in CO2 and splitting those carbon-oxygen bonds. But then what it also means is that we have to do research in our lab to really understand the mechanisms for that bond splitting and how to improve it and engineer the materials in a way that will make them effective. And that's where nanotechnology plays a role in allowing us to modify these materials at the atomic level to really be able to increase the efficiency.
Good. Well, what we know of catalysts, of course, is the catalysts in catalytic converters in cars that keep getting stolen out of Priuses because they're easy to steal and easy to cash in. And they have some very expensive platinum and palladium metals in them, which I think are called noble metals, are they not?
Yes, they are called noble metals. And that's a great example of chemical elements that are very effective in performing chemical reactions. So palladium, platinum, and rhodium as well that we have in catalytic converters are called noble metals because they are very resistant towards chemical oxidation. So it would take a specific compound in order to dissolve them because otherwise they would not react. So they are relatively inert when it comes to chemical reactivity, but they are very efficient when it comes to breaking chemical bonds. And in a catalytic converter, what we want to do is to break hydrocarbon molecules and other toxic molecules and form carbon dioxide. So it's basically the reverse of what we want to do to convert a dirty CO2 into hydrocarbons. And in order to do that, we need metals that are very effective, and noble metals are very good at that.
Mm-hmm. And when you go to split up the carbon dioxide molecule, what you want to do, I guess, from what I understand, is get rid of one of the oxygen atoms, right? So that you have carbon monoxide, or one carbon and one oxygen.
Yes. There are multiple steps that can occur in this reaction. So the first step, as you correctly mentioned, Michael, is removing one oxygen. And normally the way we do it in the lab is to couple that oxygen with hydrogen and form water. That's why we need hydrogen. plants do it a little bit differently because they are able to form evolved oxygen directly and then form carbon-hydrogen bonds from water. But we can do it by a more an indirect route. But anyway, after we remove the first oxygen, then we can kind of like choose. Then we can pick. Do we want to go ahead and remove the second oxygen and then make only carbon-hydrogen bonds? That will be one way to get hydrocarbons, such as gasoline. Or we can decide to leave that second oxygen in there, make CO, and then add a little bit of hydrogen in there, and that will lead to some other chemical compounds, such as alcohols, for example, that are very important precursor chemicals in the chemical industry or very important chemicals themselves. So that's where adding a process, an engineered process that would allow us to decide what we want to do with CO2 and whether to remove one or both carbons is very important, and what's going to make this an economically feasible process if we were able to find the right materials that would do exactly what we want them to do.
So the search is for that catalyst. And that's what
That's
what your team at Stanford is doing and a bunch of other teams around the country. Now, is there a competition going on here to see who can find that catalyst?
Well, certainly, I would say there is some competition, but it's a very healthy competition in the sense that research progresses by in many cases, some advances that are produced by the community, and then the advances produced by one research group could be used by another research group to make more advances. Mm-hmm. So that's how research progresses. It's not research done in a vacuum, but it's by sharing and contributing to the community. Mm-hmm. So there is help that we can get from other research groups working on some other aspects of this reaction that we can take as an inspiration and as a community be able to advance these processes and materials to really bring them to fruition in the end.
So it's not only competition, it's cooperation.
Absolutely, it is in some sense. Of course, if there is a way to find that specific catalyst that would allow us to run this process cleanly and sustainably the way we want, that would be an incredible achievement. And certainly many research groups around the world are trying to really hit to that specific target.
It kind of reminds me of those cooking shows you see on television where you have you have 15 minutes to bake a cake or something like that. And everybody's running around,
that's a good comparison, although it takes more than 15 minutes to develop a catalyst.
I would suspect so. Well, you came up with a very unique way of researching catalyst potential, did you not?
I think we have certainly an interesting way to approach this problem. It's something that we're exploring more in detail, and I hope it will become unique as we research this process more in detail.
And you were using an associated groups, a group associated with Stanford's, some kind of real high-tech way of looking at things and analyzing them. Would you describe that for us?
Yeah, that's correct, Michael. Nowadays, research in this field requires very specialized expertise in order to be able to understand this system very much in detail. So in my group, the expertise is on nanotechnology tools, which essentially means that we're able to build these materials atom by atom. But then when you want to understand if you've made what you think you've made, then you also require some very powerful tools that would allow you to do that. And that's where it becomes really important to have, for example, here at Stanford nearby, a national laboratory that is called SLAC, Stanford Linear Accelerator Laboratory, where there are very big tools and equipment that we can utilize to be able to understand atom by atom how our materials are made. And we have also powerful microscopes, for example, that can allow us to look at individual atoms in our material and to understand where they are positioned with respect to the others. So that's how research is done nowadays. It really requires these very high-tech techniques to be able to allow us to understand what we have made. Going back to your culinary comparison, I would say, once you put the ingredients together in a cake, then you also want to make sure that the ingredients are in their proper order and they are the way you want them to be. And the problem with our cake is that it's so small. It's usually 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of one of your hair, that we really need very special techniques to be able to understand how our cake is formed. And that's why we need collaboration with groups around the country to mm-hmm. do that.
And then you have to taste it. How do you do that?
And then, yeah, then we have to taste it. And the way we do that is by setting up reactivity lines, essentially, reactivity equipment, where we can put our calories to test. It's like going back to the calorie converters. We want to take our material and put it in that calorie converter and then analyze what gases would come out of your exhaust pipe. And if the calories works perfectly, then you would measure only specific gases such as CO2 and water coming out of your exhaust pipe. We do a similar thing. We put our catalyst in a reactor, in the converter, and then we analyze the gases that come out as we feed CO2 and hydrogen, and we want only hydrocarbons to come out of that pipe. And that's how we test if our catalyst is good or not. And some of our materials are able to make 50 or 60% of those products, compounds coming out of the pipe as hydrocarbons, which is very high and very promising. And we're trying to push that fraction to 100% such that we only make hydrocarbons out of CO2 and hydrogen. That would be our dream.
That would be the dream. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about synthesizing photosynthesis to turn that dirty carbon dioxide into clean energy, oxygen, and all kinds of wonderful things. We are talking with Matteo Cargnello, who is a professor of chemical engineering at Stanford. When we come back, where are we and where can we go?
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, what we are trying to do is take that dirty greenhouse gas carbon dioxide and turn it into so many wonderful things, things that can power our future, things that can make us really, truly energy independent. You know, Cargnello, one of the amazing things that I thought about in thinking about what you're trying to do and what you're doing is the potential for making just about every community in the world energy independent. Am I seeing things that aren't there?
Yes, absolutely. We have the power to be able to do that. I have to say, I don't think there's going to be one single unique solution to this, but we can certainly get there. We can use different abundant renewable resources depending on where we are on the planet and use those resources to create all the chemicals and the energy that we need to support our communities. Mm-hmm. I believe we can really get there.
Well, I've seen other technologies come and go that broke my heart. One of them was cold fusion. Are you familiar with cold fusion?
I am, actually. Rather familiar with it, for sure.
Well, it was one of those wonderful notions that we could fuse, I think it was hydrogen, right? Hydrogen atoms and turn it into energy at room temperature. But somehow we could never figure out quite how to do that. And another technology was that of cellulosic ethanol, which was be to take an enzyme that would eat wood, essentially, and turn it into ethanol. But we never could quite find the enzyme to do that, which was tough work if you think about it. And yet you seem to be very optimistic, and I like optimism. So why are you optimistic, Cargnello?
Yeah, I am very optimistic. I think there are some technological barriers to some of the technologies that you mentioned. So, for example, if we go back to the concept of cold fusion, there we really have a technological barrier. We know it's possible because the sun and other stars in our universe are powered by those chemical reactions. So, and we know it's possible, but we haven't been able to make it happen yet. We don't know how that technology would be enabled. But for other technologies like cellulosic ethanol that you mentioned as well, we actually know how to do it. Fermentation is a very well-known process. We can take biomass and convert it into ethanol. The reason why we're not using more of cellulosic ethanol is because there are other issues associated with it. One of it is cost. Making ethanol that way could potentially cost more than other chemical processes to make ethanol. The other problem is that there can be competition with other needs that we have as a society. And for example, in the case of cellulosic ethanol, if we make it from edible biomass, then we are displacing food with compounds that we use to make energy.
Kind of like eating our seed corn.
Exactly. So every technology comes with some advantages and disadvantages. And then it's really about understanding if we can turn those disadvantages into advantages as well, or if we can live with those disadvantages or mitigate them with some newer technology. And that's why research needs to be done on many different areas and many different fields, because at the end of the day, we will need a diversified portfolio of solutions to really fight this great problem of global warming.
Yeah, the more abilities we have, the better off we're going to be. Do you see any other potential technologies, such as the technology you're working on with respect to splitting carbon dioxide into splitting the bonds of carbon dioxide? Do you see any other technologies that have this kind of potential?
In the specific area of carbon compounds?
Well, in any area, really. Is there anything else that has this potential to be so beneficial to the human race?
Yes, I think I'm looking specifically at hydrogen. We talked about hydrogen before. I look at it as a very important stepping stone towards a sustainable society, because we really need hydrogen to make a lot of other things happen. And hydrogen is something that can be obtained in principle from pure water. So if we learn how to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, which is actually also what plants do, then we will be able to enable a lot of other processes. And we could even take hydrogen and use it directly in fuel cells to power our cars and make water only as the other byproduct and electricity. So that is certainly a process that a lot of people are looking into. And now it seems, for example, especially in Europe, there's a lot of renewed interest in the hydrogen economy. So that's one. Another very important technology that is coming out is the direct use of renewable electricity to split chemical bonds. So in order to one potential route to split the carbon dioxide, carbon-oxygen bond is by directly injecting electrons, electricity, into those chemical bonds. And there are chemical groups around the world, here at Stanford as well, some of my colleagues, but also in other universities that have been able to demonstrate how we can take electricity and water and carbon dioxide and make hydrocarbons as well. And there are some startup companies and other bigger companies that are looking into these processes. So I think the overall, the use of renewable electricity to make very important chemical building blocks in industry is going to be important in our future to really make make us become a renewable society and a society that would be powered by renewable energy.
You know, in listening to you describe the genius of plants, I get to thinking about the people who proudly hold up their tomato and say, I grew this tomato from seed. But you know, when it gets right down to it, it seems like plants are the ones who are growing us from seed.
Yes, that's true. We rely on plants at the end of the day.
And plants really are providing the key for a number of different technologies on how we might proceed into the future, into a clean future, an energy-fueled clean future.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, one other approach that I like to mention is the fact that we may exploit plants even further. So there's a study that we just published from our research group in collaboration with a colleague of mine, Harun Majumdar, in mechanical engineering, where we look at whether we can engineer plants to actually take up more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So we already know that forests around the world and plants are doing quite a little bit of work for us in taking the carbon dioxide and converting it into biomass. And the fact is that if we were able to push plants to do a little bit better, just a tiny fraction more efficient in their processes to take CO2 and convert it into biomass, we could actually reduce the overall concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there are research groups also looking at how to improve photosynthetic processes in plants themselves. So there's certainly a lot of exciting opportunities that scientists and engineers are looking into to take us into a renewable future.
So where are we right now? We've pretty well have proven to ourselves that we can synthesize photosynthesis and use that process to make some very valuable tools and products for our future. But we need to improve the efficiency of that process. How do we go about, you know, making a business out of this?
Yeah, that's, I would say, a million or a billion dollar question, because, of course, we do need to improve our processes, but not just in terms of efficiency, but in terms of scalability. They have to be scalable to a large scale, because we're talking about, when we talk about energy, we're talking about very large numbers. And that's one problem. And the other problem is that we have to make it economically feasible. We need to be able to make these chemical compounds for the clean energy scenario at prices that are competitive to the current prices that we have. Because otherwise, it's hard to imagine. There needs to be policy, but it's hard to imagine policy that would be uniform across the world. There are some very important efforts in the Paris Agreement, for example, for countries to come up with agreements on greenhouse gas emissions. But at the end of the day, we need to, as scientists and engineers, we need to make that a reality by making these renewable compounds at lower cost than we can currently do with our dirty production method. Mm-hmm. And there is like a famous saying that the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. So we cannot wait for the fossil fuel age to end because we are running out of fossil fuels. We really need to find a technology that would take us from a fossil fuel era to a renewable energy era, but not because we finished fossil fuels, but because we found something that is much better than fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And that's where the optimism comes from, because I think we're getting there.
And the fun thing about it is that plants made those fossil fuels too. Am I right?
Yeah, we are living off of nature producing those fossil fuels for billions of years, because it's basically plants and organic matter that decomposed over millions or billions of years into oil that we are now using to power our economy. So we're still relying on nature doing a lot of these processes for us. Now the problem is that nature is not able to help us at the pace we need. So we really need to help. Now it's the time for us to help nature help us again with technology.
Amen.
And science.
Now, a truly scary thought to me, what if this really does work? And we get really good at splitting the bonds of carbon dioxide. And what if we use up all the carbon dioxide?
Well, Michael, that's, I think before we get there, it will take us quite some time. Because it is true that the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is not extremely elevated. It's 400 parts per million. So every million molecules in the atmosphere, 400 of them are carbon dioxide. But atmosphere is, the volume is extremely large. So before we are able to turn that carbon dioxide and consume it all into fuels, it would take us hundreds and hundreds of years. So if you just look at the numbers, we started in 1850, so before the Industrial Revolution, the concentration of carbon dioxide was about, if I remember correctly, 250 parts per million or 270 parts per million. So in about 170 years of industrial revolution, we increased that carbon dioxide concentration by 130 ppm. So it means that it would take us at least another 100 years at the current pace of consuming fossil fuels to then turn that carbon dioxide into fuels at a concentration that is that of pre-industrial levels. So essentially, in summary, we have a lot of carbon dioxide to use in the atmosphere, and it's very unlikely that we're going to run out of it.
Okay. Do you think, Cardinal, that it will be possible for us to take the CO2 out of the tailpipe of our car and process it into fuel and put it back into the fuel tank?
Yes, that's something that we are actually currently doing already in some, not necessarily from our tailpipe, but some industrial plants have a technology that is called carbon capture, in which we take that CO2 coming out of smokestacks and we capture it using specific chemical compounds, and we're able to make pure carbon dioxide that can be used in different applications. So we are, in some ways, we are doing it. The problem is that we're not doing it as much as we should because it's expensive. Again, it goes back to cost.
Sure.
And that's where we need then policy to help us and technology to improve to make those costs come down to a level where every essentially industrial plant emitting carbon dioxide could utilize this carbon capture technology and avoid CO2 emissions.
Well, Mateo, we're just about out of time here, but I do want to get people a way of contacting your lab and seeing what you do. So do you have does your lab have a website or a way people can tune in with you?
Yes, absolutely. We have a website. It's carniellogroup.stanford.edu.
C-A-R-G-N-E-L-L-O, Cargnello Group in Stanford, and you'll get there. Matteo Cargnello, professor of chemical engineering, Stanford University, thank you for splitting the bonds of CO2 for us today.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.